Welcome to the New Books in Philosophy channel of the New Books Network. My name is Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University, and I co-host the channel with Carrie Figger. Today, my guest is Professor Kok Chor Tan. We'll be talking about his new book, Justice, Institutions, and Luck, which was just published with Oxford University Press. Kok Chor is associate professor of philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania. These days, those who think about justice tend to be egalitarian. Egalitarians hold that justice requires the equal distribution of something, or at least they hold that deviations from an equal distribution of that thing require serious justifications. Egalitarian political philosophers have long been divided over the details of egalitarianism. One may ask, what or who does the distributing? Why is equality the baseline or the goal? And to whom is egalitarian justice owed? A popular and in some circles infamous interpretation of egalitarianism called luck egalitarianism holds that egalitarian justice is primarily concerned with correcting the influence of luck on social advantage and disadvantage. The thought driving luck egalitarianism is that individuals should not be socially disadvantaged, or for that matter, advantaged, for features of their lives that have simply befallen them. Rather, social disadvantage and advantage should be tied to an individual's choices. Now, stated as such, this moral principle looks deeply attractive. But once one takes up the task of spelling out the details of a luck egalitarian theory of social justice, many difficulties arise. Just to cite one such difficulty, some critics have wondered whether luck egalitarianism would hold that ugly people are entitled to socially subsidized cosmetic surgery. After all, one's looks are a matter of luck. In Justice, Institutions, and Luck, Kok Chor Tan formulates and defends a distinctive and original theory of luck egalitarianism. He holds that luck egalitarianism is concerned not with luck as such, but rather with the ways in which social institutions transform matters of luck into advantage and disadvantage. From this starting point, Tan develops a global luck egalitarianism. Now, there's a lot to talk about here, so let's turn to the interview. Hello, Kok Chor Tan.
Hello, Bob.
Welcome. How are you doing this morning?
Very well, thank you. And thank you for inviting me to New Books in Philosophy. I'm looking forward to talking to you.
Well, I'm looking forward to talking to you, too, about your book. Thank you for joining us. Today, I'm talking with Kok Chor Tan about his new book, Justice, Institutions, and Luck, The Site, Ground, and Scope of Equality, which was published this year with Oxford University Press. This book provides a state-of-the-art roadmap, I would say, to the current debates in political philosophy over the nature of egalitarianism. And it also provides a defense of Kok Chor's own distinctive version of egalitarianism, what he calls institutional luck egalitarianism with a global scope. The view holds that egalitarian distributive commitments apply at the level of social institutions rather than at the level of personal interactions. It also holds that the ground of egalitarianism, the reason why equality matters at all, lies in the distinction between what individuals choose as opposed to what befalls them as a matter of their good or bad luck. And finally, Kok Chor holds that egalitarianism is global in scope. This is an exciting book. There are lots of moving parts, to contest, certainly a lot to talk about. But before we get to the details of the book, Kok Chor, tell us a little bit about yourself.
All right. Perhaps I'll say a bit about how I came to be interested in political philosophy. And right. As you may know, or as some people may know, I've done much of my work in the topic of global justice. And I sort of entered into political philosophy with questions of global justice very much in mind. And then this new book also actually has a whole section on questions of global justice. Well, returning to graduate school, at a point after graduation from college, I had some vague idea that I might return to grad school to pursue a degree in philosophy with a focus in political philosophy. But before I did that, I spent some years working in the United Nations at the entry level. But what struck me while I was at the UN is the frequency with which the two competing norms that are well known, or the two competing norms of international relations, came to the surface in any serious discussions in the United Nations Security Council, for example, about human rights, democracy, and intervention. And the two norms are the norms of universal morality, as expressed by the idea of universal human rights, and the norm of state sovereignty, right, and the idea of non-intervention. And right. These two competing ideals, if you like, within the United Nations Charter and the competing norms of international relations came to the forefront frequently in any serious discussions, debates in the United Nations. And this sort of animated my interest in global justice. And it seems to me that there's a sort of quintessential philosophical question here, quintessential philosophical task here, that of trying to reconcile two competing ideals, reconcile two competing commitments, right? And so when I returned to graduate school, I started I began work on a dissertation on trying to make sense of the limits of international toleration, right? Is there an ideal of international or global justice such that any society, any state must comply with in order to claim sovereign status, right? Are there some universal standards that sovereignty is conditioned on? And that resulted in my first book, Toleration, Diversity, and Global Justice, in which I argued for a what we might call a cosmopolitan conception of global justice that states enjoy sovereignty only if they observe not just basic human rights, but pretty robust standards of liberal democratic ideals and principles. This sort of led me then to my second book, which is on global justice, but focusing less on what we might call political rights and more on economic rights. And the question in this book was that of global economic justice. But here again, the idea of plurality is very much in the forefront. The question is, how do we understand our commitments to people at large, right, in terms of distributed justice to individuals at large in the world, versus our more local and patriotic commitments to people in our own countries, right? And again, here's a tension that we understand that anyone can appreciate, right? We believe that there are universal standards of right and wrong that apply to everyone, regardless of their relationship to you. On the other hand, it's part of common sense morality that people who are close and near to you or especially related to you are deserving of special consideration. And in the arena of global justice, right, the one obvious way this tension comes to fore is between universal conceptions of global justice, distributed justice versus patriotic commitments and special concerns of special consideration for your compatriots. And this book, again, tried to argue for a cosmopolitan conception of global distributive justice, and it's only the cosmopolitan ideal of justice sets the parameters, right, within which states, nations may pursue their own patriotic ends. Right? So again, there's a priority of cosmopolitan justice that, however, should give space to patriotic commitments. But by giving cosmopolitan justice priority, it shows that one may exercise patriotic concern, show special concern for your fellow countrymen, only within the confines, right, of global justice.
Right.
So these were sort of it was my, I guess, in some the many things that sort of influenced my the way I my interest in global justice. But perhaps one important influence was having worked in the UN and having experienced personally the important tensions within international relations theory and international relations norms that are thought that philosophy is well suited. In fact, philosophy is geared to try to make sense of.
Right. So, you know, I did not know this about your background working in the UN, but it is fascinating to hear or to discover about a fellow philosopher, especially a fellow political philosopher, you know, when they have a background in actual real world politics. It's often illuminating. And now that you mention it, I could see how your background at the UN has influenced your writing in general. There are many points in your new book where you use an example, for example, or you mention some fact that I am very, you know, was very impressed with here and there, saying, wow, well, Kaktra really knows a lot about international relations. And now I see exactly where some of that has come from. So why don't we move on to talk about the book? Would that be okay?
Yeah, sure. Yes.
Sure. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the subtitle of the book is the Site, Ground, and Scope of Equality. And these are three distinct kinds of questions one can ask about egalitarianism or about egalitarian distributive commitments. And the book is divided into three parts according to those three types of question. So why don't we begin then where the book begins, which is with a discussion of the question of the site of equality. Now, you advocate a view according to which distributive egalitarian commitments apply to what we now think of as the basic structure of society following Rawls. But as you know, perhaps better than most, this is a controversial commitment. Some people have thought that if we're egalitarians, we need to be egalitarian across the board, including in our individual, interpersonal kinds of relations. Can you tell us a little bit about why you think the site of equality is something institutional rather than interpersonal?
Yes. You know, that's a very interesting, I think, informative and line from John Rawls that I'll paraphrase here. And it says something like this, that justice shows the limits or shows the way, but the good shows the point. And I take that, I mean, that's very, I think it's a terse remark, but it could be interpreted in different ways. And one way I like to understand that statement is that, well, justice shows us how we should go about pursuing our ends. And particular justice's main goals show us how we can pursue our ends freely and equally with regard to other people, right, who may have ends to pursue. But it is the good, it's the ends themselves that shows the point, that shows the meaning of why we exist, of showing the meaning of why we do the things we do. It is what gives value, if you like, to our lives, right? So that's the aim of justice, mainly to show us the way by which we pursue our ends, and of course, to show us the kinds of ends that we may have in order to pursue them. Then if justice has that end, then to say that this is all encompassing, such that there's no space left, that the good is to be defined and reduced to justice, seems to defeat the purpose of justice, right? On that understanding of what justice is, right? So to put it more generally, then, one of the aims of justice, right? Why we care about justice is that people have different ends in life, different values, different conceptions of the good life. But that's sort of let's call it a starting point of any discussion of justice, that thing ends. Another presumption then is that not many of these, there's no one good life to pursue. Right? There are many equally valuable ways of life. Now, some ways of life may not be valuable, let alone equally valuable from my own conception of good, but that doesn't mean that therefore I'm correct, right? That there may be different ways of life that are subject to reasonable disagreements. People can reasonably disagree about what is valuable in life. And I may accept that a way of life is not for me, but I'm in no position to say that therefore that those ways of life, they're not in compat, that they're not like mine, are to be disregarded. Mm-hmm. So we have this idea that there's a plurality of good, if you like, plurality of ways of life, plurality of conceptions of good, as our second starting point. Then the aim of justice is to set the background rules, if like set the background terms by which individuals with different ends to pursue may pursue these ends on terms that are fair to others, right? And so that means there must be a way of drawing, if you like, the boundary between the demands of justice on one side and, if you like, the demands of personal pursuits on the other, right? And I take it, right, my argument in the book is that the institutional approach provides a way of approximating this boundary. We need to draw the line somewhere, and the institutional focus of the sort that Rawls and others have argued for, is a very effective way, feasible way of drawing the line between the demands of justice and the demands of personal life.
Right. So, but can you tell us a little bit about the position on the other side of this? So it seems to me, although I tend to agree with you at the end of the day about the institutional focus of justice, but it does seem to me that there's something to the G.A. Cohen style concern that, again, to put it very roughly, well, if we really care about equality, then shouldn't equality be the overarching aim of our lives and not just the thing that happens at the level of our political institutions?
Right. Yes. So that's a very important question. And Cohen, you just mentioned, raised a very, I think, serious and difficult challenge for the institutional view. But so one way of responding to that challenge, or trying to make sense of it, or trying to mute its force, rather, is that to try to get a sense of what it means to take the equality as the great goal, the all-encompassing goal, right, of morality, if you like. Imagine that equality is the dominant or the master goal, right? This straight away will mean that any kind of personal decisions, actions that you want to make at a personal level, at the interpersonal level, will have to be informed by egalitarian considerations. Now, if you think about that, that seems to be an overly demanding view of what morality requires of persons. Right? Straight away, it makes it very difficult even to decide whether I'm entitled by this cup of coffee this morning, right? What is that egalitarianly motivated? Is that going to have egalitarian consequences? It makes it a goal that's almost impossible for an individual to try to realize. But it also makes it very difficult to live what we would ordinarily accept to be legitimate personal pursuits. Are you permitted to favor or give some extra resources to your child's education, like extra piano lessons on weekends or activities resources that might be very well used, right? Social egalitarian purposes, and if you use them in other ways. Right? Mm-hmm. So the concern here is that if one takes equality to be a moral goal across the board that regulates all spheres of life, we may have a kind of morality that is not suitable mm-hmm. anymore for human beings, right? And if you want a morality that's fitting for human beings, given their legitimate interests, given the things that they value, then to take equality as the dominant and the comprehensive regulative principle seems to be demanding too much of human beings as we understand them.
Right. So let me ask one more question along these lines, because I could imagine someone like Cohen responding or reacting to what you've just said in the following way. One might say that the fact that a proposed demand of justice would be really demanding and hard for us to meet yes. should be taken as bad news for us,
right.
not bad news for the proposed demand of justice,
yes.
right?
Yes.
So that demandingness itself, although it's a relevant consideration, I think, on anybody's view, maybe not Cohen's, but on many other views, the fact that a demand is hard to satisfy, or maybe even really, really hard to satisfy. Right. I mean, that's a relevant consideration, but yes. could that be the decisive consideration?
It's interesting. So it's not the demandingness itself that will be the problem, but the scope of the demand that sort of leaves no space for personal life. So suppose we say that suppose we agree that justice should be focused on institutions. This leaves open the question, how demanding should these institutional principles be? Right, they could be extremely demanding institutional principles. This still provides a way of drawing the line boundary. Then we have very strict institutional rules, and then leaves correspondingly a tighter space of personal pursuits. Now that'd be a fine, I think, with the institutionalists, with the institutional egalitarian, because that's still a feasible way of drawing the line. Right, but to say that equality has to be not restricted to institutions, but to regulate all of life, then this gives just, I think it's not, it's just the money, but just has, just there's no feasible space. There's no conceivable space left for individual personal pursuits. And so I think that's the concern here, right? It's not with demandingness as such, but the nature of the demand that it sort of removes, right? It obliterates any way of any space because it doesn't provide a way of drawing the boundary between justice and personal life. Now, so Cohen may have a complaint that the way we understand institutional rules, these rules are too lax, right? But the solution might be then to have stricter institutional rules, not to change the site of justice. Now, if he thinks that, however, we need to change the site of justice in order to give greater traction to our demands of, to our commitment to equality, then the question is, where, then what's the target now, right? If there's, how do we draw the line? And he says, well, there's no way of drawing the line, but we do have to allow space for personal prerogatives, as he acknowledges in his work, right? Personal prerogatives mean those things that you may do for yourself, legitimately, right, despite what morality demands of you, but using a term coined by Samuel Scheffler. He allows for personal prerogatives, but then the question is, how do we make sense of what counts as acceptable prerogatives? There must be a theory, like an account, a principled way of making, allowing that, look, your demands here falls under the category of permissible personal prerogatives, but not Joe's, right? You may need to have a way of doing that rather than saying it's up to individuals, right? So the worry of Cohen then is that unless he has a alternative as to how we can approximate the boundary between justice and personal life, there's the risk that his theory of equality might be not just simply overly demanding, but might defeat the purpose of justice, which is to allow persons to pursue their ends on terms of fair to others.
Right. Excellent. Well, good. Let me move on now to the second sort of question that your book poses with respect to the so-called the what you call the ground of equality, you hold, across a series of, not only this book, but a series of very well done articles, you defend a view that I should say has gotten sort of a bad reputation in political philosophy over the past decade or so, a view called luck egalitarianism. I want to get into the specifics of your own version of luck egalitarianism in a minute, because it is a distinctive version. It's an institutional version. But can you tell us again now, just in general terms, what you think luck egalitarianism as such is? That is, what kind of view is it? What does it hold?
Right. So luck egalitarianism is the view generally that says that a person's life prospect should not be less good, be worse than another's because of bad luck alone. Right? And that if there are any differences in distribution, right, amongst people, it should be due to their choices rather than to circumstances outside their control. Right? And the idea of luck egalitarianism is that if there are such inequalities, inequality is not due to people's choices, but due to their bad luck, then there's a need to mitigate, right, this inequality. There's the need to move resources around, so that resources do not, the distribution of resources do not simply reflect the differences in people's luck.
Excellent. So let's ask now about your particular version of luck egalitarianism, yes, which you in the book call a modest version of luck egalitarianism. Right. Can you tell us a little bit about why you think it's important, right, for luck egalitarians to be modest? Sometimes in philosophy, modesty is not always taken to be a virtue of a view, but maybe that's a problem with philosophers. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about the ways in which luck egalitarianism can grow immodest and problematic, and why you see the need for a more modest kind of proposal.
All right. Okay. Thank you. So the standard view of luck egalitarian, luck egalitarianism, has been subject to several quite powerful objections. Right? So one objection we might call reductive objection. It sort of says, look, if your view is that a person's entitled to assistance, to a redistributive assistance, only if this is due to bad luck but not to their choice, then imagine this person who squandered all his earnings, the savings, this resources away now is on the streets, about, you know, they're going to perish on the streets or die of starvation on the streets. Are we saying that society owes this person nothing? Right? So it's a challenge against the lucky Gadarin view that its commitments issue in pretty counterintuitive conclusions, moral conclusions. So this is one problem that's been raised against the lucky Gadarin view. Another view, another challenge that's been raised, and it's a kind of reductive view too, I suppose, that says that, look, if really we're interested in mitigating effects of people's bad luck, then, well, luck happens in all spheres of life, right? One may be uglier than another person, right? This person may feel himself quite unlucky. Does this mean that this person should be entitled to state-subsidized cosmetic surgery? This is a pretty well-known objection that Elizabeth Anderson has raised against the lucky Gadarin view, right? So lucky Gadarin seems to be have too much to do, right? It's an absurd view that it has to be in the business of compensating for people's bad luck in all areas of life, and this seems to be a theory that's going to exhaust itself, right? So these are two main concerns that have been raised against the position, and there are others, but let me start with these two. Now, the problem I see is that the critics and maybe the proponents of the view may be also themselves guilty of it, but the critics certainly sort of treat lucky Gadarinism as a much more comprehensive doctrine than it should be. Right? It treats it as an account of the whole of morality, when originally the lucky Gadarin view, right, is very much a view about distributive justice. Right? It's not a view about how we should treat people, right, in general, across the board, across all spheres of life. But it's a view about distributive justice. And we understand distributive justice in a very special way. It's about how we allocate, right, resources, surplus resources among people in some kind of cooperative, productive arrangements, right? Then it has a very much narrower domain than some of its critics take it to have, right? So imagine that. So just illustrate what I just said. So we can say that there are two kinds of different domains of morality, right? There's the domain of humanity or human decency or basic human rights, right? This is the domain of within such a domain, we say that, look, whenever someone's in need, no matter how it comes to be in such dire straits, someone should come to this person's assistance. Someone's drowning. It might be his own fault that he's gone to this river when he shouldn't. Well, someone should help him. Someone's on the verge of starvation because he's been careless. Well, someone should help him. These are serious moral shortfalls. These are matters of moral urgency. We don't ask how is it he has come to be where he is, right, or how she's fallen to the state she has. It might be her fault, it might be his fault, but it's of no matter because it's just a matter of human decency and basic human rights, if you like, that people are assisted when they're in such severe straits. Now, in matters of distributed justice, the issue is quite different. Here we're talking about, look, someone's life is less well off because he's been less careful with his earnings or with his resources. The urgency of the question is quite different, right? So if we understand distributed justice to be concerned with a very special domain, that of how to allocate fairly, right, resources above the threshold basic needs, then the claim that lucky Gadarinism issues in reductio, results in absurd conclusions is, I think, avoided, right? Because the lucky Gadarin view says nothing about matters of moral urgency. It doesn't say anything about this, what you do with someone who's deprived of basic needs. If the person is in need, some other kinds of principle kicks in. Principle of humanitarianism, principle of basic needs come in, right? That's a theory of justice, right? Lucky Gadarinism is about how to allocate resources amongst people who already, we presume, have their basic needs met, right? And this sort of distinction between what you call humanitarian commitments and commitments of distributed justice, this is not it's an arbitrary distinction. It's a distinction you find, I think, in people like Rawls and Thomas Nagel and others, right? For example, in the Law of Peoples, Rawls makes a distinction between distributed justice commitments, which has to do with allocating resources in a way that's fair amongst people where they are able to meet basic needs, and a duty of assistance, right, which involves helping people who are unable to service very basic urgent needs. and he takes these to be different moral aims. And of course, interestingly for Rawls, he argues that in a global context, we have a duty of assistance, but no duty of distributive justice, right? But the point here of my comments here is that if we understand that these are different, there are different moral domains here, then we can understand Locke egalitarianism more modestly as a principle falling within the domain of distributive justice. And thereby, this avoids the claim that Locke egalitarianism has implications, right? The people who make the charge, right? I think they make the charge, they do because they take Locke egalitarianism to have a much broader scope or a domain of application than it should have.
Right. And that's an exciting component of the view, but you've got another move that you lay out in your book, which I also thought was quite well done, which is to say that, and let me know if I'm getting this correct, that Locke egalitarianism, despite the name and maybe despite some of the more ambitious, immodest perhaps proponents, that your version of Locke egalitarianism is not concerned primarily or strictly, it's not obsessed with luck, right? It's more concerned with the ways in which social institutions transform matters of brute luck into social advantage and disadvantage. Yes. And so the Elizabeth Anderson style criticisms all think that or seem to be fixed on the idea that luck egalitarians have got a problem with bad moral luck, with bad luck and the moral implications of bad luck. Your view has got it that it's not really the luck that's the concern. Luck is neither just nor unjust. It's the way in which social institutions transform luck into social advantage and disadvantage. Is that right? Am I getting you right there?
That's right. Yes. That's right. Yes. Yes.
Excellent. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because that's the way in which the luck egalitarianism connects up with the institutional site, right?
Right. Yes. That's so. Right. So there are two ways of suppose we begin with the view, right? And so let me try to defend the institutional luck egalitarian view in two ways, right? One is sort of an indirect way. Suppose we begin with the view that justice is institutional, right? Justice has an institutional focus, but also justice comes about because of institutional arrangements of some sort, right? And Rawls, again, has a very nice phrase in one of his writings where he says, look, there's nothing just unjust about nature itself. It's what institutions make of these facts, natural facts, that render things just or unjust. Now, suppose we begin with that without arguing for it, but because suppose we begin for that. And of course, the part one of the book, the institutional part of the book, supposed to argue for that, right? But suppose now we say, look, we have a case for the institutional view now, right? Now, let's try to see if that is compatible with Locke egalitarianism. Can Locke egalitarianism, if you like, then sign on, right, to the institutional view? And one of the arguments I want to make in my book is that, yes, it can easily sign on to that view without losing what is really important about the Locke egalitarian view. But so if you marry the institutional view with the Locke egalitarian view, then you have the view that says that, look, what matters from a point of view of justice, not what about luck as such, right? But it's about what matters is how institutions, right, make of these of bad or good luck. How institutions, if like, translate these matters of luck, and that there's nothing, right? So what the first argument is, there's nothing in luck egalitarianism that precludes this special and more limited reading of the Locke egalitarian idea. There's nothing in it itself that says, look, it's incompatible with the institutional view, right? There's no basic premises in Locke egalitarian view that says it has to be read more broadly, more trans-institutionally. But there's nothing that precludes it being tied to the institutional view. And moreover, you actually have a more persuasive, more plausible kind of Locke egalitarianism. And if you take into account the original purpose, objective of having wanting a Locke egalitarian view in the first place, tying into an institutional view actually serves that purpose very well. Right? So you maintain the objective of Locke egalitarianism by tying to an institutional view. There's no inconsistency there. There's nothing in Locke egalitarianism that says you cannot tie to an institutional view, and that and you have a more defensible view of Locke egalitarianism. Right? So so this is sort of, I say, an indirect way of bringing the two together, right? By showing that there's nothing at odds with trying to bring luck egalitarianism to the institutional view of justice, assuming you accept the institutional view of justice. And not only is there nothing odd with that, nothing inconsistent about that, you actually have a view of luck egalitarianism that is more persuasive, precisely because it's more modest. And you don't give up the original purposes or goals of the luck egalitarian view, which is very much a position within distributive justice. Now, but there is also a more direct argument, right? And here's that we need to have a way of, we have to have a way of distinguishing between what the kinds of luck that that we should be concerned with and the kinds of luck that people should take responsibility for, right? Ronald Dworkin has presented this distinction in terms of brute luck on the one side, right? The luck that people need not be held responsible for, and option luck that arise out of people's choices, luck having to do with people's choices. Suppose I choose to invest in some stock, Facebook, for example, and now out of bed, I'm not doing so well. Well, that's an option luck. I take responsibility for that, right? That's an option luck. There has to be a way of, the view cannot be one that says, look, all luck should be mitigated, right? The effects of all luck should be in, and no luck, and only choices should be left free to play itself out. So there must be a way of drawing the line between what Dworkin calls brute luck and option luck. And I try to argue in the book that one way of trying to make sense of one way of drawing this line, again, is to take the institution approach, to say that, look, in society, what really the kinds of luck that we take people to be not responsible for, the kind of luck that should not make their life less good than others, tend to be luck associated with institutions, right? Institutions like class differences, educational opportunities, access to healthcare. These are the kinds of institutional conditions that issue in luck, right? That we say people should not be are responsible for, and that society should have a role in trying to mitigate. Now, and then on the other hand, there are different kinds of luck that arise between people's decisions within the rules of institutions. We tend to say that, look, the rules are fair and you play within the rules and everyone's playing within the rules and things don't turn out so well for you, that's your own problem, right? And we tend to hold that view in society. So again, I take it that the institutional view actually provides a way, as it did in the justice and personal pursuits front, parallels that, if you like. Distribution view provides a way of drawing the line between the kinds of luck that, from the point of view of distributed justice, people should be held responsible for, right? The kind of things that happen to them if they play within the rules of institutions, and the kinds of luck that it should not be held responsible for, the kind of structure, societal structure, if you like, that generate differences and entitlements and benefits for people. Right? The weaker argument is that, look, there's nothing incompatible with bringing tying luck egalitarianism to a independently argued for institutional view of justice. And the second, more, I guess, controversial view, but a stronger argument is that, moreover, right, understanding luck egalitarianism on this institutional view allows for a way of making sense or approximating or making a distinction between the kinds of luck that people may be held responsible for and the kind of luck that we may call brute luck that they need not be held responsible for.
Right. So let's pick up on that. Excellent answer. At the root of any version of luck egalitarianism, including your own, as your responses have been demonstrating, at the root of any of these views is this set of distinctions. In the first case, it's a distinction between luck and choice. And then there are distinctions further to be made between brute luck and option luck. And maybe there are some other kinds of distinctions to be drawn further within even those categories. But let's just stick with those two levels of distinction between, on the one hand, luck and choice, and then between two different kinds of luck. You're keen in the book to suggest that the luck-choice distinction in particular doesn't get entangled with certain familiar metaphysical quandaries about freedom of the will, for example, or sort of metaphysical questions about responsibility for actions or what it is to be an agent. That is, you want to keep luck egalitarianism and the luck choice distinction sort of neutral or non-committal with respect to the deeper metaphysical issues. Yeah. But I could imagine, and I think I can understand why a luck egalitarian would want to keep his or her doctrine free of these metaphysical entanglements. But I could imagine, in fact, we can name some people who've written about distributive justice issues and luck egalitarianism. I'm thinking of Susan Wolf, for example, who think, no, the metaphysics and the moral psychology stuff is really what all of this is about. And one of the objections to luck egalitarianism is that it gets those metaphysical and moral psychological commitments wrong. It doesn't understand properly the metaphysics of agency or misconstrues something about the metaphysics of free will. And that once we understand these metaphysical, moral, psychological facts, that's the real point at which luck egalitarianism is vulnerable. So could you say something about about that?
Well, that's a very good question. It's a very, very hard question.
Sorry.
It's good that you raised it. And I try to consider this challenge in my book, and perhaps it's certainly, I'll say that certainly my treatment is far from satisfactory, even from my own point of view. But let me say a few things just to switch some of the concerns or to see how to make the best, if you like, of luck egalitarianism. Now, suppose determinism were true. That is, that there's no free choice. Right? Let's just suppose that were true as a metaphysical claim. Now, does this show that luck egalitarianism, the luck choice principle, as I call it, is invalid? What doesn't show that? It simply show that, therefore, that the principle has an application in our world. Right? The validity of that principle as a distributed principle, I think, stands. It's not dependent on whether determinism is true. It just simply shows that, okay, the principle is true. The principle is true, even though determinism is true. But then, unfortunately, in such a case, that principle has no application. Right. So, I mean, okay, that's not very, doesn't claim very much, but shows that the validity of the principle itself doesn't ride on metaphysical truth. And that's still the attempt I was trying to suggest in the book. So it just simply shows that, okay, well then, everyone's to be responsible, no one's to be held responsible for anything, right? Across the board, the lucky egalitarianism, there's no space or choice as such, and everything else is due to luck, determinism is true, and we should have to distribute everything else, and there's no what's inapplicable now in the luck egalitarian principle is the space left for choice, right? So that'd be one implication, but it doesn't show the principle itself to be false. So right, so that's what I was trying to get at when I said, look, it doesn't depend on the metaphysics of freedom determinism. Right? Just simply changes the application of the principle. But the other point is that what kinds of inequalities are egalitarians concerned about, right? Social inequalities that get egalitarians excited when they discuss these things, right? So a lot of these cases are quite uncontroversial, and they are inequalities that we all agree, whether we call any particular view on the metaphysical debate about freedom determinism, that we tend to accept that our inequality is not due, that the people should not be held responsible for. I suppose one person is better off than another person because of the class he's born into. Well, we all, I think, most egalitarians say, look, that's not the kind of luck that we should think should affect this person's life prospect. They should have a better life just because he was born to a better class. And conversely, someone who's born to a poorer social class should have a worse life. Or that our lack of having access to decent education, or lack of having access to healthcare, and so on. Right? These are things that that we don't disagree about. Right? And one of the points I'm trying to make in the book is that there's a core sort of agreement amongst egalitarians, no matter what their metaphysical commitments might be, if they held any, about these sorts of things. That we say, look, wealth due to inheritance, that's a kind of luck that we should try to mitigate. And most egalitarians, if they accept egalitarian, right, most political philosophers who are committed to some egalitarian principles will agree that. Now, a person who has poorer health prospects, poorer health because of lack of access to medical care, right, because of lack of public health care, will say again is that this person is not doing so well because of bad luck. And that there's no the metaphysical debate doesn't come in at all. Now, a person who has suffered bad health because in spite of information available to her, because she smokes or insists on smoking, in spite of information advising her to do otherwise. Now, we will say generally this person, you know, in some ways is responsible for a situation. And of course, if her situation is dire, humanitarian considerations will kick in. But again, there's no disagreement here whether she is at some fault or not. We don't say, let's consult the metaphysical debate. Right? So as a society, I think we are very much in agreement here on what the kinds of things that we hold people responsible for and the kinds of things we don't, right? And I take it that some philosophers say, look, we don't have a theory of what we hold people responsible for, what we don't hold them responsible for before we come up with a theory of justice. My take is very much that way around. We take it to be a fact, right, that the theory of justice must accommodate, that people shouldn't be held responsible for the poorer class that they've been born into, right, or of their race or whatever, right? They should not be disadvantaged because of these things. We don't need a theory of justice to tell us that. These things, in fact, inform our theory of justice, right? So the point here is that there is sort of a certain convention, societal conventions we have on what is it that people should be held responsible for, what is it they have to take responsibility for themselves, and what is it that society should to take responsibility for, right, between what's really luck and what's not. There's sort of a consensus on that, at least on the main issues, right? And that these we come to agreement on these things as a society without any having taken stance on the metaphysical debate, on the determinism freedom debate, right?
Right.
So at least the core cases that motivate discussions about equality, I think, are very much I don't say transcend, but they sort of bypass, if you like. They're debates we engage in about equality without having the need to take a stance on the deeper metaphysical question about freedom and determinism, right? One might, again, to borrow another phrase from Rawls, I say, look, the luck choice principle is social, it's not metaphysical. It's what we have an account of what society takes. Some certain convention here about what people may be held responsible for and what they are not to be held responsible for, and we have a theory that responds to this convention rather than to think that we need a theory to come up with that.
Right. So, would you say that I want to move on in a second to the remaining bits of the book, but let me ask very quickly now: would you say then, in light of the kind of response you've just given, that some version of the luck choice distinction is internal to egalitarianism as such? That is, that the luck choice distinction is not simply a principle upheld by luck egalitarians, but any version of egalitarianism has to, perhaps even at its core, draw a distinction between what people do and what simply befalls them, and the significance of that difference.
Yes, that's right. Yes, you put it well. That's right. So it's one of the points I try to make in my book, that no matter what kind of egalitarian view you have, a lucky egalitarian view, or it's opposed as candidate rival view, democratic equality, no matter what views of equality you have, at some point you have to make the difference between luck and choice has to come in your construction, in the construction of your theory.
Right.
Yes.
Mm. Okay. So now that you've mentioned the alternative view, let me ask you. those of us who've been following these debates within egalitarianism feel compelled to fall on one side of the luck egalitarian democratic equality line. That is, the main opposing or competing view for egalitarians. The main competitor to luck egalitarianism is a view, again, associated with Elizabeth Anderson and Sam Scheffler and others, that's called roughly now democratic equality. Can you tell us a little bit about what this rival view is and what, you've got a couple of, I think, very nice criticisms of this rival in the book. Can you walk us through that a little bit?
Sure, thank you. So one way of understanding what this view is, which takes us back to some points we made just a couple of minutes ago, it's not that it is a view that has no use for the luck choice distinction. It's not that democratic equality makes no use of this distinction. But the difference between democratic equality and lucky egalitarianism, as I try to understand it, is that it gives different accounts of why is it that distributive equality amongst a group of people matters. It's an account of the grounds of equality. And here's the difference between democratic equality and lucky egalitarianism. Democratic equality, as I understand it, takes it that equality matters only amongst people who are in some kind of political relationship with each other, right? And more specifically, in some kind of democratic relations with one another. Equality matters only in that context when there's already a commitment to some kind of democratic relationship or democratic reciprocity amongst individuals. Right? Now, once that commitment takes off, I would argue the luck choice principle comes in, but it doesn't motivate that commitment. And what makes a luck egalitarian view is that the luck choice principle is what motivates the commitment. Right? It takes it that, look, people should not be worse off because of bad luck. Now, my modification of it is that people should not be worse off because of what institutions make of their bad luck. Right? But basically, it's the luck choice principle that motivates the commitment to equality. Right? And rest in the democratic equality view, it is some other commitment to democratic reciprocity that motivates the commitment. And I think this is a very important way of understanding the difference. If I may say so, because if you, like we said earlier, most equal egalitarian views have to make some use of the luck choice distinction at some point in the construction of the theory or in the application of the theory, right? So it cannot be the case that the only difference between luck egalitarianism the distinguishing difference between luck egalitarianism and democratic equality is that luck egalitarianism makes use of the luck choice principle, whereas democratic equality makes no use of that at all. The differences in how they motivate their different commitments to equality, the role the luck choice principle plays in motivating egalitarianism in the luck egalitarian view, and it doesn't play that role in democratic equality. But in the democratic equality view, some other commitment, democratic reciprocity, that motivates it. And so a very general way of looking at the difference is that the democratic egalitarian view takes equality to be very much a political ideal. It's an ideal of justice that takes root only amongst people who are already in some kind of shared political arrangement. Whereas the luck egalitarian view, and I hold that to be an advantage, of course, this can be disputed, right? But I hold that to be an advantage of luck egalitarian view, doesn't tie egalitarianism to political arrangements in that way. Doesn't allow egalitarian commitments to hinge on some more basic political commitments. It takes egalitarian commitments to be a basic moral commitment on its own right, right? And this allows it, as I argue in my book, to have a global application, whereas democratic equality, in order for democratic equality to argue that equality has global scope, has to do the additional work of showing that the global arena is a political democratic society of a sort, and that's going to be quite difficult to do.
Right. So let's pick up on that, because this brings us to the third part of the book, the part that's concerned with the scope of distributive egalitarianism. Just to repeat what you were just saying, you take it as one of the main virtues of your version of luck egalitarianism, but maybe it's a virtue of luck egalitarianism as such that it's easy to see on luck egalitarianism how relations of justice or demands of justice or obligations related to justice could exist between people in quite different parts of the world, for example. And it looks as if the democratic egalitarian view, the competing view, will have a harder time, as you were just saying, in making sense of global distributive justice commitments, because if, after all, justice is something that exists between those who stand in certain kinds of political relations that enable or allow them to show a certain kind of democratic reciprocity to each other, then it looks as if people in democratic societies, you have to tell a different kind of story about why wealthy Western democracies owe duties of justice to people living in non-Western, non-democratic societies. Mm-hmm. But it looks as if, on a straightforward luck egalitarian view, without the institutional component built in yet, that it's easy to make sense of global justice concerns, because after all, where geographically one is born is every bit as a matter of brute luck as, you know, what color one's hair is or whether someone's born with a disability or not. Now, so let me then, having said all that, let me now ask about how your own institutional conception of luck egalitarianism translates into a global a view of equality with a global scope. And let me put it in the form of a kind of critique.
Okay.
Or at least a mild kind of challenge. Okay. It's not yet a critique. So it looks to me that maybe intuitively the institutional focus of your egalitarianism, namely that it's concerned with the way institutions translate matters of brute luck into social advantage and disadvantage, looks to me like the institutional focus might not fit together so well with a cosmopolitan or global conception of the scope, maybe for roughly the kinds of reasons that you bring against the democratic egalitarian view, which is to say that if luck egalitarianism is institutional in its sight, then where there aren't institutions that translate matters of brute luck into advantage and disadvantage, there couldn't be concerns of justice. And that looks like the situation we might be in with respect to global justice. Does that sound like?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you. So let me. So let me see how I can best respond to the very, very good question. So let's see. So one difference then, this difference between the institutional view and the democratic view is that the institution of luck egalitarian view simply says that, look, so long as institutions are designed in such a way as to have that kind of impact, the kind of impact being the impact of translating brute luck into disadvantages of people, concerns for justice arise. The democratic equality view doesn't just talk about impact. It says that distributed considerations arise only under institutions that have certain normative characteristics, right? I.e. democratic features. The democratic egalitarian view would have to show not just that there exist institutions globally that impact people in different ways, but that these institutions can be properly described normatively as democratic institutions. Right? So this is an important difference, right? It doesn't require that. So my view of luck egalitarianism requires the existence of some kind of institutional mechanism in the background. Institutional arrangements that affect people's life on account of luck, but it doesn't require that these institutions be understood, be characterized normatively as democratic institutions. There's a normative characterization in the kind of institutions that there must be in order for justice considerations to arise. But having said all that, the question remains, what kind of institutional arrangements do we have globally that affect people's lives in this way that translate brute luck that they may have or simply circumstance that they find themselves to be in into actual advantages and disadvantages. And I say that there is a lot in the world out there, right? In the kinds of institutional arrangement we live under that actually has the effect of translating brute luck into actual social disadvantage. So imagine a person living south of a river, right? A nameless river, just say, and this is a fact of nature, and it's some kind of hypothetical global state of nature. That fact itself is not it's not a just unjust. It might even be the case that the terrain, the land south of this river is less fertile than land north of it, and he's doing therefore less well than people born or who find themselves north of this river. But in a state of nature, that's neither just nor unjust. It's just a fact of life, and we understand it to be neither just unjust because we assume that simply this person could then just cross the river to the more fertile area if he or she wanted to, right? But the world we live in now is not that way, right? We have boundaries. We have a international system that allows states to guard their borders, and that this is an institutional arrangement, I'll say, that has now turned this what might otherwise be a mere brute luck fact, a brute luck fact about a person being born south of the river, that fact is not translated into a question of justice, because there are institutions in place that he's obliged to comply with that says to him, he may not just willy-nilly cross over to the more fertile side of the river. He may not do that because this belongs to another country and he belongs to a different country and the borders that would stop him from doing so. So just the fact of territorial boundaries, right, of states having the right to regulate who comes in, that alone, I think, this gives just one example of the kind of global arrangement we have that has the tendency of turning what might otherwise be brute law and of no consequence for justice into a matter of justice, right? Because these institutions now turn certain natural facts into matters of justice by saying to people, look, you have to watch where you go, you have to be in certain places, you have to respect property rights of people on the side of the river because there's a different nation or different terrain, territory, and you have no right to come over, right? So a natural fact is now a matter of justice precisely because of institutional arrangements. And there are other examples I try to give in the book of other norms, international norms and principles of international relations that are in place that have the effect of turning what would otherwise be brute luck into actual social advantage or disadvantage of people.
Okay, well, that's very good. And it does turn on a conception of what an institution is that is a little bit more expansive than what one might have thought, given the emphasis on the basic structure, where it looks as if when you're discussing the site of, right, of egalitarianism, institutions there mean sort of things that we consciously build, things that deliberately or in some decided way make these transfers of, you know, facts about the world into social advantages and disadvantages. And now it looks as if, and I'm not saying that this is necessarily a problem, it's just now it looks as if institutions, the term is being used in a broader sense,
right,
to include things like norms, right? Yes. You know, if you're a country, you get to, or if you're a territory, it doesn't have to be a state. There could be institutions, even if there are no states, if there are norms in place where, you know, your little territory, you get to decide what to do with the resources on it and not someone else. Let me move on, though. This is a fascinating question, but I wanted to make sure we had time to discuss one of the topics that's central to the debates about egalitarianism as they've been conducted in the last 15 to 20 years, which you set aside in the book,
right,
and that's the equality of what debate. So, as you know, you can have what different theorists have different views about what the, as it were, the currency is of egalitarianism. Is it resources? Is it welfare? Is it capabilities? Is it opportunities for welfare?
Yeah.
And the discussions get rather complex very quickly in this matter. But you say a couple times in the book, yes, that you're going to set aside the equality of what debate, and your ambition is to give a conception of the site, the ground, and the scope of egalitarianism that remains neutral with respect, right, to the currency question. What are we distributing when we're distributing something equally? And I'm just curious, that's a very thorny debate. I can understand why one might try to figure out other things about equality before getting into the question of the currency of equality. But let me just, again, pose as a sort of half-formed challenge.
Yes.
One might think, and maybe with some plausibility, that as a methodological point, or as a point of the sort of proper order of analysis, as people used to say, that getting clear on what distributive equality aims to distribute, what kind of entity it's interested in giving equal shares to, or distributing equal shares of, maybe that's the kind of question that has to be answered first before we can talk about, well, what does the distributing, how deep does the distribution go, and does the distribution apply across political borders and boundaries? That is, maybe someone might think that the equality of what debate is the first,
right,
matter on the agenda for egalitarianism. Could you speak a little bit to this?
Right. No, that's a good question. And it's a very challenging question. So let me think through this as I speak, I guess. So when I noted that my discussion is neutral on this question, I do not mean to say that what is the solutions we give to this site, ground, and scope question will not generate a response to the what question, right? So I want to say that we can get started on the site, ground, and scope question without setting that first, and that regard is neutral. But I want to argue that once we set on the site, ground, and scope question, we can actually have a view on what the proper metric of equality should be. Now, so just for example, we agree that equality site should be institutions, right? Let's just suppose we take that to be the case. Then it suggests right away that welfare, right, to say that, look, it should be just happiness across the board, right? Which straight away, I think we sort of ruled out that response quite naturally, because that view, the welfare guardian view, is just very incompatible with the site question. So once you say that, look, here's the reason why the site of equality should be institutions, and should be institutions for this reason, right? Again, allowing for differences in conceptions of good and allowing space for personal pursuits on terms of fair and free with regard to others, then this straightway takes us away from a welfare egalitarian view, I would say, right? That it sort of inclines us towards something more like a resource view than a welfare view, right? So one of the things I want to argue in this book is that although people may think that the matrix question, the question of what does it want to distribute, may have to come first, I was trying to suggest that if we settle the site, ground, and scope question first, we may actually have a clearer sense as to what the proper currency of equality should be. Now, having said all that, right, I also tried to suggest in the book that the case for luck egalitarianism, right, did not require, doesn't ride on a pre-commitment to any unit of equality. I argued that even one were to be a egalitarian, right, case for luck egalitarianism, and in particular understood in the modest way, I argue remains. Right? So in that respect, it's neutral. But again, once you have the complete terrain of equality, as I attempted to sketch on the book, on the site, ground, and scope, my hunch is that, I've not worked this out, my inclination is to say that once we do that, we'll be coming closer towards a resource view rather than a welfare view of equality. Now, of course, as you mentioned, this is a big debate, and there are, of course, the independent arguments one can give for each of these positions. Now, the welfare view, the straightforward welfare view, I think, is very much the business equality is to maximize welfare, subjective welfare. That seems to be a problematic account on its own, right? It's subject to various problems, including the problem of expensive taste, right? If I need expensive more resources because of my expensive taste, then on the welfare guardian view, I should be given more resources because I need more to make me happy, and you can be happy with less, therefore you should get less, right? So that's an independent concern with the welfare view. So I've not gone into any of that in the book, but my sense is that once we get clear on the site, ground, and scope view, the questions about the matrix, the currency of equality, hopefully will be clarified. Right. So I'm not sure if I answered the question. I guess the way of answering this challenge, which is a very good one, is to ask. Suppose we agree that, say, something else like capability, right, as developed by Amartya Sen and Martha Nussbaum, is the proper matrix of equality. How would that change the discussion in my book on the site, ground, and scope? And right now, the capability, I think, is a more plausible view of the matrix of equality than, say, simple than the simple welfare view. So that's a more plausible kind of the currency of equality, the capability view. Now, I would want to argue that this will not change questions with any of the discussion on the site, ground, and scope. Right? After all, we again capability, egalitarians or people concerned about capability will have to also make space of personal freedom, and therefore they would have to accept the limited side of equality, focusing it on institutions. They would have to have an account of why equality matters, and the kind of considerations that raised in favor of like egalitarianism, I think, should be with some modification applied in their case too. I think there should be all the more, I think, concern that equality has global scope.
That seems right about the capabilities yes. theorist who, you know, part of what's interesting about the debate between the capabilities theorists and the resources is that at the end of the day, it's, at least to me, not clear how much of a difference there is between them. There are different nuances.
Yes.
But I do think that mm-hmm. for the more sophisticated welfarists out there,
mm-hmm.
The sort of opportunity for welfare
yes.
types,
yes.
Someone could, and this is a much longer debate that than we could get into now, but somebody of this more sophisticated welfarist view could just, you know, run the modus tollens version and just say, well, that your view of settling or trying to get clear on the site, ground, and scope questions first winds up showing that welfarists, that this is not a promising account of equality.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that just shows the problems with trying to settle the site, ground, and scope question right. before you settle the currency question, right?
Yes. Yes.
But again, this is this is much more than one can get into.
Yeah. No, thanks for raising that. Yes. I just stressed that in my comments earlier that I was talking about a straightforward, like simple welfare egalitarian view, but the more sophisticated ones, as you mentioned, developed by people like Richard Arneson and even G.A. Cohen himself, who has a view that he calls access to advantage, which is kind of a welfare view, but sophisticated one, we'll certainly certainly reckon with these ones. But again, I would say that, look, if we have a more sophisticated welfare view, like Cohen's access to advantage, then again, I want to argue that when we talk about access to advantage, what kind of advantage are we talking about? How do we operationalize that, if you like? And I think, again, be institutionally given as to what kinds of advantages we have, right? So that this again, I think, suggests a site, an institutional site, sorry, for justice. But anyway, I cut you off. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. Yeah. This is the beginning of a really exciting conversation, stimulated by a really excellent book. I have to say once again that Justice Institutions and Luck is a really, really fantastic book. And I would even say that one of its real virtues is that one walks away from it, even if one picked it up without knowing much about what's been going on in the debates over egalitarianism. Not only does the book develop a very compelling set of views about what egalitarians should think, it also, I think, gives readers who might not otherwise know much about these debates a real solid survey of the terrain of the debates. So that's a philosophical achievement on two levels. So having said that, what's next for you, Kaktur? What are you working on or thinking about now?
Okay, well, thank you. I think of two projects, longer term projects, a book length project at the moment. And this is just a very initial exploratory stages for both of these. So one has to do with problems of global justice under non-ideal conditions. Right? So I've written about global justice, as I mentioned at the start of this interview, and these writings of global justice mainly have been focused on identifying ideal principles of global justice. What I'm doing next now is to look at what happens when these principles aren't complied with, what happens when these principles have been violated in the past. Right? So these will introduce questions of reparations, interventions, responses to world poverty, and so on. So it's a discussion of responsibilities of individuals and states under conditions of injustice, right? When principles that we think of that we should have in a world are not present or not complied with, what kinds of responsibilities we have. So this is one project on problems of global justice under non-ideal conditions. The other project is more broadly on moral philosophy, and it has to do with relationships and morality. So that's the question one wants to ask in this project is what is it about certain kinds of relationships people have between friends or family members or colleagues and so on that generate special concerns and obligations for people in that relationship? Or what is it about these relationships that gives rise to these special commitments? And secondly, how do we understand the limits of these special commitments? Right? At what point does, say, kinship degenerates into nepotism or friendship friendship into cronyism? Right? So we agree that friendship is valuable. What is it about friendship that renders these special concerns among friends important and valuable? And at the same time, what is it? How do we know when the show of special concern among, say, friends is illegitimate and in violation of certain moral norms and norms of justice? So that's the project and the second project that I'm starting to think about.
Well, both of those sound really interesting, and I'll keep an eye out for your work on those two topics. And maybe when one of those books comes out, we can have you back for an interview on New Books in Philosophy. But for now, Kakchor, you've been very, very generous with your time. We've held you here for a little bit longer than normal, but it was very, very, very enlightening discussion of your book, Justice, Institutions, and Luck, The Site, Ground, and Scope of Equality. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, I thank you, Bob. Thank you for the invitation to talk to you. And I enjoyed the discussion very much. And thanks very much for your very, very good questions. I'll continue to think about many of them. So thanks very much, Bob.
Excellent. Take care now.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to my interview with Professor Kakchor Tan of the University of Pennsylvania. We were talking about his new book, Justice, Institutions, and Luck, which was published by Oxford University Press. I'm Robert Talese, your host. This is New Books in Philosophy. Thank you for listening.